So listen, what we're doing right now is we're going to prank call Rebecca.
That's
we
it.
We think that she has room on her voicemail because she said she did.
Unfortunately, we both asked her to remove her voicemails on the same day. So I text her and I was like, oh, I tried to call you about something. She's probably like, they're obsessed with voicemail. They're so old school.
Those sisters, they're weird. Okay.
All right, let's slide dial her.
So what's your issue going to be this time? Are you still mad about the ruggable?
Yeah, I want to be able to do the ruggable. And then I have another one. I want to call her about, I want to see if Gavin could be a baby model next time.
I love
time.
It. Okay, good.
All right.
Call has been forwarded to an automated voice messaging system. At the tone, please record your message. When you've finished recording, you may hang up or press 1 for more options.
This is Priscilla Maccabee from Ruggable. I understand that you don't appreciate our patented corner roll design, as you have mentioned on your very public Instagram account. We would like you to send us the rug back so that we can destroy all the evidence. Please call to confirm that you received this message, or we will be forced to sue you for defamation. The number is 555-RUGBACK. The number is 555-RUGBACK. Hashtag defamation proclamation. Have you ever put a hashtag in a voicemail?
No.
I can't wait till she gets that.
Why put a hashtag?
Defamation proclamation is hilarious.
Welcome back, friends. This is Emily Thomas, and you are listening to the Mom Struggling Well podcast, the podcast that helps you love your actual life so that you don't need to run away from home. So listen, at the top of the show, you heard Rebecca getting prank called by Priscilla Maccabee, and I could not stop laughing about the defamation proclamation hashtag. Zero reason to put a hashtag in a voicemail, but if it's that good of a hashtag, you kind of just use it wherever you can. You know what I'm saying? Anyhow, if you are interested in getting more shenanigans in your ear holes, then once a week, Katie and I just do a bunch of stuff kind of like that on Patreon, two additional times a month. And it's going to be, I did some crunching of the numbers. It's like 9 cents a day. So if you have 9 cents a day to spare, head over to patreon.com/momstrugglingwell. And those episodes will come right to your phone. I wanted to thank Julie, Samantha, Amber, and Elizabeth, who just joined us yesterday. We're so happy that you're here. Make sure to get in the private Facebook group, ladies. And also, we just started a new thing where there's a code word that if you send it on your email, you will definitely get on the show with your questions and your things for Rebecca and I to solve and things you want to say to me and Katie. So anyway, Patreon Strugs get a code word. And if you've always wanted a special code word and be part of a secret club, join us as a Patreon Strug. Okay, so this week's story was Sarah May. It is not an easy story to hear, but it is a story of ridiculous amounts of hope and healing and freedom and restoration. And so I promise there will be hope coming at the end. And there's just so much encouragement along the way. So I don't think it's like a tearjerker one. I don't know. It might be. Tell me if I'm wrong. We do talk, though, about abortion. There's some abuse stuff going on. It's not graphic, but just know that in case that's a area that is hard for you. But I promise it's worth listening to. I would love to meet with you on Instagram at 9 a.m. Central on Thursday. Can you just put that on your, just pencil me in or pen me in? Ooh, let's get real serious about this. This is happening, people. I just want to do like a little chit chat with you. So join me at Instagram at 9 a.m. Central, because I think most of us are in Texas. Probably not all of us, but according to my research, a lot of us are in Texas. So let's do 9 a.m. on Thursday and I'll wear my cowboy hat. Just kidding. I don't have one. Have some questions ready, some comments. Don't make me talk to myself on an Instagram Live. Gosh, that sounds like a form of torture. All right, ladies, let's go ahead and get started on my talk with Sarah May. So go ahead and tell us about your family.
Okay. So my family, I've been married for 16 years to my awesome woodworker husband, and I have a fifth grader and two middle schoolers, seventh and eighth grade. We just started public schooling them 2 years ago. So I had homeschooled all the way through for 11 years, and then we felt like the Lord was leading us to put our kids in school. So now they're in school.
We just did the same thing.
Did you really?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Oh, I don't think I realized that. And then we've got one yellow lab who's very large, and he's a year old.
So good. So you have girls or boys or both?
So I have bookend girls and a boy in the middle, which actually is awesome because you know how they say like the middle child tends to get forgotten, which is sad, but you know. but because he's our only son, it's like a perfect like right in the middle. So he can't get forgotten.
That's funny. That's the same with me and my brother and my sister. I'm the oldest and yeah, we have a middle brother. He's lovely. Okay,
Me too.
We're both firstborn. Oh my goodness. Mm-hmm. Yes. And what are you on the Enneagram? I'm sure you know.
Well, I think a 4-wing 3.
Okay.
My husband is convinced I'm a 4 for sure.
He's so like really artistic and
a little moody.
Feelings, my husband, yeah.
Lots of feelings. My husband was listening to the Annie Downs Enneagram Summer and he heard the 4 and he was like, I was like, I don't know. And he's like, oh my gosh, you are definitely a 4. And I was like, okay.
There you go. Okay, so your story is, you say, complicated. I think that's a nice way to say it. What I love about your story, though, before you get into telling it to us, but you mentioned that dysfunction doesn't have to be your legacy. And that's so helpful for those of us who didn't grow up, you know, like in the Cleaver family or whatever. And although for young people, that was like a show on TV.
Like, what are you talking about? More like they didn't grow up in what looks like the perfect blogger Instagram,
there you
homeschool
go.
Mom.
There you go. Way to be relevant. I'm like pulling things from the early 1900s and they're like, I don't understand. But you also say that victory is on the table. And I love that because sometimes we decide that it's over for us. Everybody else is still in the game, but we are not. So anyway, just kind of tell us your childhood with your mother, your story.
Sure. Absolutely. So it really begins when I'm 14. And I have just moved in with my alcoholic mother, but I don't know that she is an alcoholic.
And you chose that, right? Like you wanted to go.
Yes. Yeah. I'm gonna back it up, but I want to start it here because this is where sort of there's probably always been dysfunction, but this is where in my mind it really, really began for me. So I'm 14. I hear my mom making a drink. I've confronted her. She's not having it. She laughs at me when I confront her about being an alcoholic. She tells me, you know, like, so what? So I'm sitting in this bathtub. I'm feeling completely, you know, first of all, I'm 14. So I'm going through all the hormonal stuff. Very, very alone. Have no words for how I feel. Like now I can look back and go, well, I was manipulated and gaslighted and all of these different things. And we can define those terms. But I was sitting there and I'm looking at this pink, you know, plastic Daisy razor. And I'm thinking, I wonder if you can kill yourself with like this little plastic razor. And I yell out to my mom, maybe I'll kill myself, which is such a desperate teenage thing to do, right? Yeah. And really, I didn't want to die. I just wanted her to run in and be like, I love you, like, you know, all those things. And she said, go ahead, I dare you. Mm. And so that was so significant. And it was sort of the moment that I felt you are on your own. Like that was the sort of vow that I would say I agreed with, maybe with the enemy whispering in my ear, you know, like you are alone. You're on your own. Figure it out yourself. Fix yourself, you know, all these things. So going back, my parents were divorced before I was a year old. And so I had always lived with my dad. He won custody of me. But I would see my mom in the summers and she was like the coolest. Like I literally felt like I have the coolest mom ever. I used to say I want to be just like her or Madonna. Like that was the thing. Yeah. Right. Like 80s child.
Yes.
Was not, you know, raised in a Christian family. And my mom and Madonna were like top notch. So finally, when I'm 14, I'm having these conversations with my mom. And she's like, you know, you can live with me if you want to. Like you're old enough to decide. And I was like, well, I really want to live with you. I mean, I loved my dad, but I had a stepmom that I did not like at all. And that's probably a whole other book anyway, so that I'll never write. But it was really, really, I hated her. I wanted out of my house. I loved my dad, but I just felt like it was sort of like a living hell. So I told my dad, like, I want to go and live with my mom. And he was really sad, but he knew that I was 14 and really got to decide. And so I go and I move in with my mom.
And he knew about your mom's substance abuse, I'm assuming.
Well, I don't think so, because it's confusing. Like, my dad knew that when he would come home from work, he would find me in my crib. He said I'd have dirty diapers and like tons of bottles around me. Like, I hadn't been touched all day. And my mom, you know, would be like, well, your dad was just never around and I was really lonely. Like, I think my mom had a lot of postpartum depression. She said she would sit and stare at the wall like all day long. So I don't think he knew her current struggles. And quite frankly, I think between the time that they got divorced, you know, which really 14 years later when I move in with her, I think it had progressively got worse. Like, I don't think she was an alcoholic then. I don't think any of those things. In fact, there's a really significant piece of the book, The Complicated Heart of My Story, where I can sort of trace where I think the pain got too much for my mom. And I will just briefly tell you, my mom was accused of sexually abusing both my sister and I. It wasn't true, but it caused so much pain and craziness for a season of our lives that was just, I think, broke my mom. Like, I think it was just too much. And I really believe that that's probably when she got really bad. And
isn't that sad that an absolute lie could do that?
Yeah. And again, it's just more dysfunction, like how all the lies came about. I mean, it's so crazy. Like, my sister was kidnapped by her dad when she was really little. Like, my mom had dropped her off for a visitation and like he never came back. And so then it's just like this crazy story. Like, I'm jumping around. I'm sorry, but it's just insane. So I think, and it's not an excuse for my mom's behavior, but it's just an explanation. Like, one of the things that's important to me, and this isn't just about the book, but in the book, like, it's this idea of like, what if you could trace a life? Like, what if you could understand why somebody became the way that they did? Not to excuse their behavior, but just to understand and have some compassion, you know?
It gives a context. Yeah.
It gives a context. And so, you know, like, my mom's journals are at the end of almost every chapter in my book.
I loved
so like,
that.
Right. Perspective of like, what is she thinking? Like, what is happening in her world while like my world is falling apart? In what ways is her world falling apart? You know, things like that.
I want to take a quick break to tell you about a fitness watch that I've been having fun with called Polar Ignite. The Polar Ignite Fitness Watch offers you a full view of your day and provides guidance to help you achieve a more balanced life. Wouldn't we all love that? Polar Ignite is thin, it's lightweight, and it makes 24/7 data tracking of all of your fitness goals a reality. This watch has so many features. It keeps track of your sleep quality, it tells you about the sleep cycles you were in, and then it makes it easy to understand by giving you an overall sleep score. The Polar Ignite also gives you suggestions on how to train the following day based on how well you recovered from yesterday's training and life shenanigans. It's a great watch for people who don't know where to start with working out as well. It actually suggests exercises for you, and it even has animations to tell you what those exercises mean. You can tell the watch how long you have to work out, and it'll adjust the training times accordingly. It also does important things like heart rate monitoring, it has GPS tracking, and it also has breathing exercises to help you calm the heck down. So if you're in the market for a fitness watch, head to polar.com/momstrugglingwell and check it out. Again, that's polar.com/momstrugglingwell. So how did you get all those journals? She like gave them to you?
No. So my mom passed away in 2016, and I had gotten this call from the hospital to come, and I had been in Thailand for 10 days. Okay. There's so much here. You're asking great questions. I've not talked about a lot of these things actually. So way to go, you.
Oh, well,
so my mom had begged me to, I know I'm jumping all around the story, but my mom had begged me to come and visit her, and I said, I can't because I'm going to be in Thailand for 10 days with this mission organization. She was like, please, please, like, I really want you to come in April. Like, the Lord told me that I'm not going to, she had become a Christian by this point. So she was like, the Lord told me I'm not going to, you know, I'm only going to live for like a year longer. And I was like, Mom, that's crazy. Like, you know, whatever. And she'd had like 9 lives by this point. There's a million other stories in between what I'm telling you now. But she really was like, please. And I was like, I can't. I will come in May. So we made a plan. She just wanted to go. It was like her bucket list. She wanted to go to the beach. She wanted to eat seafood on the beach. She wanted to go to the Dali Museum. And I was like, Dolly Parton? And she was like, no, Salvador Dali, like the artist. And I was like, oh, okay. So this was in Florida. So we made the plans. We booked the hotel. We did the whole thing. I get back from Thailand. Of course, I'm exhausted. So I sleep for like a week straight practically. Well, then I get this call and it's like, do you want us to resuscitate your mom? And I was like, what are you talking about? And they were like, your mom's in the hospital. And I was like, what? Like, how long has she been here? And they're like, well, she's been here since like April 5th. And I had gotten back from Thailand on April 10th. And I was like, why did nobody call me? And she's like, well, your mom didn't want to bother you. And I was like, what? And so they're like, we need to know what you want to do. And I was like, wait, I still don't even understand what's going on. So anyway, I won't go into all that now, but it's in the book. But anyway, so I end up flying there. And I'm literally on the plane and they keep calling me like, what do you want us to do about this? And I'm like, I don't know. Like, I'm getting there as fast as I can because she lived in Florida and I was in Pennsylvania. And so I get there and it's excruciating and awful. And essentially they tell me like, you need to do comfort measures for her. And
was it because of alcohol?
Yeah, ultimately. Okay. She had stage 4 cirrhosis of the liver that she'd been diagnosed with 9 years before that. That's why I'm saying she had 9 lives. We had been through a roller coaster of her.
My dad has had the same thing, so I get it. He got a liver transplant, so.
It wouldn't give my mom one because she'd been an alcoholic. And what was really sad is she ended up living 9 more years after that because they were all, she's going to die in 2 months, and she didn't. And so that is a whole other source of, like, sadness. But anyway, so essentially we get her into hospice. She's in hospice care. The whole thing is excruciating. I feel like I'm killing my mom because she's going to starve to death. It's terrible, blah, blah, blah.
Oh, my gosh.
I end up, while she's in hospice, going to her apartment because I just want to go into her place, gather some things because I have to leave the next day to go back to my kids. While I'm there, I find all these journals. So I collect them, of course. And after she passed away, which again is a whole other story that's in the book, but I read them all. And it's literally the most agonizing reading I've done in my whole life, because one, I felt like for the first time I met my mom, and two, it was like I had no idea how much pain like she was in.
Wow.
Like, she was so lonely and had only ever wanted conditional love, like, from her dad, and he just never gave it to her. And it was just really agonizing to read that. And I remember driving in the car during the on the Florida highway, just screaming at the top of my lungs, like, why didn't I know, you know? Mm. And so that was like just totally agonizing. All to say, long story to tell you, that is how I got my mom's journals. And so I really sifted through them carefully, and I wanted to honor her in what I put in my book, and wanted to make sure that she had a voice in the story. I didn't want it to just be about me and like my junk with my mom, but like, what is her voice in this?
And you did an amazing job. It was so like, I would read those at the end and be like, oh, like, you could tell the little girl in her that was just desperate for love. And you just, I just wanted to tell her like, oh, sweetie, like, I get that you're feeling those things. Those things aren't true, you know, but she's a grown woman and hurting you and not meaning to. And gosh, it's so complicated is the perfect word for it.
Right? It's so complicated. It's so complicated. And it, to even add to the complication, is that she always claimed Jesus. Like, before I ever even became a Christian, I can remember her sitting on her bed, like when I moved in with her, with like her beer and her Bible open. And nothing wrong with drinking beer, but when your mom's an alcoholic, it's significant that she has the Bible open in front of her. She's reading the Bible and claiming Jesus and like treating me like crap and my sister like crap and, you know, whatever. And that was also like just extremely confusing. But I do think that she held on to God like through it all. But it wasn't until she finally surrendered to him that she was able to put down the drink.
So you move in. I remember there's the scene you paint when you first arrive with like the couch that's torn up and the dog and the boyfriend, and things are great for a bit. And then all of a sudden they're super not great.
Yeah. So that's the thing. Like at first I move in, you know, and I move in, it's with my mom and then she has her 20-year-old boyfriend and then my sister who is like probably 9 when I move in. And it's awesome at first because I can do what I want. I really don't have any rules. I don't have to clean my room. I can keep it however I want. Like I can watch what I want, listen to. It's like a teenager's dream. There's basically no rules. And on top of that, because it's like this whole new situation, like my mom's boyfriend's great. Like he's like, do you want a sandwich? Like, can I make you something? And he's like toasting my bread and making me a sandwich. And that sounds like the small thing, but I didn't have that before, like at home. And so having somebody do that for me felt like so special. And I was like, this is great. I could get used to this, you know? And then, yeah, probably a month in, and I can't remember exactly, but at time, it was sort of an insidious, like you don't know when exactly it happened, but at some point you're like, my mom is really mean to me, like just verbally abusive, emotionally abusive. Again, I didn't have words for it. So I always beat myself up, but she would gaslight me. And so
let's talk about that.
Yeah, let's talk about that. So gaslighting is this word we hear often in politics. And I only learned it this past year in relation to what I grew up under. So this is what it's like. She would be putting me down. She was very sarcastic, very cutting, such a verbal genius and making you feel like the stupid, like most incompetent person ever, you know? I mean, she would straight up say things to me like, oh, you're so stupid. Or like, you're so like, oh, don't smile. Like you're ugly. Like and then I would finally like break and I would be like, mom, you know, like that really hurts my feelings. And then it'd be like, Sarah, like you're being so sensitive, you know? And I'm like, mom. Like, so she would have this amazing ability to turn it around on me. And then if I got angry, it would be like, hey, like, calm down. Like, why are you so upset? Like, you have a problem. And I tell people gaslighting is like this. It's like if you were walking along and somebody punches you in the face straight up, like they punch you in the face, you're bleeding. And you're like, why did you do that? And they're like, what are you talking about? Like you ran into my fist. And you're like, no, you punched me. And they're so good at manipulating you that you literally walk away believing that you are such an idiot for running into their fist. And so you end up blaming yourself. You end up beating yourself up. You feel worthless. You feel like you're such an idiot.
And then how could you be so messy and get blood all over everything? Like it doesn't matter which way you turn.
That's exactly right. And then you actually feel bad for the other person. Like, I'm so sorry I hurt your fist. Like, it's so bad. Yeah. And that's what gaslighting feels like. And so that's what she would do to me. But I didn't have those words. And so I felt crazy. Another symptom of gaslighting is you absolutely feel like you don't know what is up and what is down. You don't know what is true. You just feel crazy and you don't trust your gut. You don't trust, you have zero confidence. And you think that everything you think must be wrong. And so what happens is you grow up and then you don't have any confidence and you don't know what is true and what isn't. And you're extremely naive. And anyway, so that's what it was like with her. But, and people will always say to me, well, why didn't you just move out? Well, I was 14 and I don't even think I thought that way. Like it wasn't even like a thought in my brain. I think I thought, well, I told my dad I was moving. So like now I'm just here and this is my life.
And you're kind of weighing the pros and cons. Like there's an extreme amount of freedom that's got to be nice as a teenager.
There's still an extreme amount of freedom. That's right.
Which is kind of cool.
And so,
and if things aren't great with your stepmom at your first house, then
confusing.
Yeah.
Yes. And so the thought really didn't cross my mind that I could leave until later. But by that point, I'd gotten a boyfriend and I didn't want to leave him. He had become like my whole world. And it's not because I necessarily loved him. It's just because we became each other's refuge because he had a mom who was a crack addict. Like, you know, he was in poverty, didn't have a dad. And the worse it got with my mom, because it just kept getting progressively worse, like the more we just clung together.
Yeah, your confidence is nothing at this point. So of course you're going to stick around.
Yeah. And so, and then that's a whole other thing because I spend all my time with this boyfriend. He basically even spends the night because he would sneak into my room after I'd go to bed and just spend the night and then leave early in the morning. And so like my mom never even knew. And sometimes I think she had a job or she worked nights. So then there was that. And there's so many parts of this story that my mom really put me in bad situations that she didn't mean to, but she was so foolish. Before I even had the boyfriend, I had an ex-stepbrother. my mom was married five times. So I had an ex-stepbrother move in and I was 14 and he was 18. And my recollection is that I had bunk beds. So she let him sleep in my room. Now, My recollection could be wrong. It's possible he came into my room every night. It's possible. But my recollection is that because I had bunk beds, that's where he slept. And he was very twisted, very, very twisted. And he had like been in a gang, like legitimately, and just was really pretty psychotic. But he gave me lots of attention and he awakened things in me that I thought like were great. I mean, I thought they were good because he must really care about me. But really what he was doing is when I can look back and I can look at my 14-year-old daughter, and if an 18-year-old touched her, I would be like, this is wrong. This is not mutual. This is very, very wrong. But I didn't know that.
Well, and because your mom put you in that situation. So you, part of you is like, this is parent approved. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yes. And she loved him. I mean, she always talked about how much she wished she had a son all the time. And loved him. And so that just, you know, it was like, well, you know, mom loves him, you know, blah, blah, blah. So that whole thing just was really messed with my heart because it was super confusing. And that when he left, I never saw him again. And it was just really weird and confusing. And I never thought much of it until I was in college and I was telling somebody about it, a mentor. And she said, Sarah, that is sexual abuse. And I was like, no, 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 because he didn't force anything on me. And she was like, Sarah, you were 14 and he was 18 taking advantage of you. And he was extremely manipulative. He knew exactly what he was doing. I mean, he really groomed me well. Even when I was 12 and he was 16, he began grooming me. And so it was like, it hit me, but then it still didn't hit me until I had kids. And like, I have a 14-year-old daughter now. And now I'm like, oh my gosh. And this is just, that is the nature of, I think, how the enemy just tricks us so well.
Another quick break to tell you about a product I'm spending my own cash on, Stitch Fix. When I wear something Stitch Fix sent me on Instagram, that's the only time anybody ever comments on my clothes. So I feel like I've got some hard data that they are way better at picking out clothes than I am. And that's fine. I can't be good at everything. So most of us are moms, and that means we have kids, and that means our kids have to wear clothes in order to be part of society. So Stitch Fix can help us in this area as well. Our kids are individuals, and so they have some feelings, especially as they get older, about what they wear and what they don't wear. It's so easy, and moms of little, tiny little babies who just lay there enjoy the fact that you can dress them, because as soon as they can talk, they start having opinions. So Stitch Fix Kids is an online personal styling service that helps your kids get clothes they love. You can get clothes, shoes, and accessories sent directly to your door. Stitch Fix has styles that will suit any and every kid. The kids get to complete a style profile quiz, and then a stylist sends them a handpicked box full of goodies based on what they love. And if you're listening in the UK, Stitch Fix is there now as well. What I love about Stitch Fix is there's no subscription required. You can choose to get automatic shipments, or you can only get a new piece when you ask for it. The shipping's free, exchanges are free, returns are free. Discover new styles and find unique pieces with Stitch Fix. You can get started today at stitchfix.com/kids/SWP, and you can try Stitch Fix and get an extra 25% off when you keep everything in your box. And as a bonus, Stitch Fix is going to waive their $20 styling fee when you use the coupon code SWP, when you use this show's special URL. So go to this website, stitchfix.com/kids/SWP. That's stitchfix.com/kids/SWP. One last break to let you know about a company that I love. It's called Minnow. Did you grow up with Bob and Larry and the rest of the VeggieTales? Now your kids can too with Minnow. It used to be called Jelly Telly, so if you're confused, don't be. They just changed the name. So Minnow is an ad-free streaming video app that's designed for your kids, and it has 30 episodes of classic VeggieTales, plus thousands of other shows that teach kids about Jesus. You can feel safe letting your kids choose any show that they want to watch on Minnow, and you won't have to worry about what might pop up, and there aren't any commercials. So visit gominnow.com. That's gominnow.com, and use the coupon code STRUGGLEWELL to begin your 7-day trial that's completely free. You can start streaming anytime, anywhere on your phone, on your tablet, your TV, or your computer. You can even download your favorite shows and stream them on multiple devices at once. They got you covered. With Minnow, kids discover God in stories they love, and parents find expert help and everyday encouragement as they lead their family in faith. Minnow helps you have the conversations that really matter with your kids so you can experience the goodness of God together as a family. Minnow, stories kids love and values that parents trust. So use the coupon code STRUGGLEWELL to start your free trial today at gominnow, that's M-I-N-N-O.com. And remember, the coupon code for a free trial is STRUGGLEWELL, all one word. So at what point did you become like aware that this wasn't right, or how did you get out of all of that?
Like with my mom, you mean?
I mean, yeah, I guess all of it's not right.
Okay. So let me add a few other things into the story, because it's really important to understand, I think, the full picture. So now I'm with this boyfriend, we're finding all of our life in each other. And so at 16, I find out I'm pregnant. And I find out I'm pregnant because I'm watching like a cartoon in the morning and eating my Fruit Loops, and I throw up. And I'm like, that's weird. And
such a little kid.
Right, right. I mean, 16. I mean, 16, like, you're old enough. I know kids are having sex. I know they're doing things. But 16, like, I look at that now. My youth group girls are 16. And I'm like, my precious girls, like, you know, you are just babies to me. But anyway, so find out I'm pregnant. Of course, I'm freaking out, shaking, you know, awful. And I, in my brain though, I'm like, well, I guess we're going to get married and we'll get a trailer and, like we're going to have a family. And then, my mom had found out and I, you know, tried to talk to her about it, but she checked out completely. And this is really significant.
Too hard for her to handle.
It's too hard for her. Like, she literally numbed out. Like, we never talked. Like, she couldn't even, I remember her face. It was like a blank. It was like she became a little girl and was so scared. And like, I remember my grandmother calling her and like yelling at my mom for this. And she just like took the phone and like hung up and just was blank, numb. And I found out later that she had had two abortions, but she'd never dealt with them. And that's really important, because if we don't deal with our wounds and our pain, this is how we so often put it on our kids or damage our children more than we already will as, you know, humans who sin, right?
Yeah, for sure.
And so, so that was extremely lonely. And then during this time, I actually was going back to see my dad in the summer, because I would go to my dad in the summers. And my grandmother, when I had told her, she said, I'll have it taken care of. And I was like, well, what do you mean? Like, I'm going to keep the baby. And she was like, she just hung up the phone on me. And so I moved back to Pennsylvania and I am in this, I'm so sick. I have that. There's a name for it. I don't know what it's called. I've had it with all of my pregnancies. I can't remember the name off the top of my head. Yeah, that's probably what it is. It's, I don't know. It's where you're sick, literally throwing up morning, noon and night.
Yeah.
Hyperemesis. Like, I had to go to the hospital, get IVs. Like, it was terrible with all my, I probably would have had more children if it weren't for that. Because that just carried through all my pregnancies. But anyway, I was so sick. I'm 16. I'm so frail. Like, I'm so frail, so weak, so alone. And like, nobody will talk to me. And I can't talk to people about it because it's this big secret, right? So it's just consuming me. And I'm all on my own thinking, I'm going to have this baby. But now I'm in Pennsylvania. I can't talk about it. My family wants me to have an abortion or send me away to New Jersey, like to have this baby where I'll live with my aunts and nobody will know, because my stepmom was very, she was Catholic and she was very pro-life. And so I was just constantly torn. And I remember telling them like, well, I will, what if I choose to give the baby to a family who can't have kids? But like, nobody liked that idea. Oh. And so my stepmom wanted to keep the baby and raise it as my brother or sister, which I thought was so twisted, and I didn't like her, so that was even worse, or have an abortion. Like, those were my options. And I didn't know I had other options. Like, and I finally got worn down, and at 3 months along, I had another grandmother to visit me, and she was like the first one to touch me, like to show me any love. And she put her arms around me and she said, Sarah, like, if you just have the abortion, then you can go to things like prom and you can have a life. And, you know, she was so tender, and I was so worn down and so sick that I finally was like, fine, like, I'll have the abortion. And so I just remember crying the night before and saying sorry to my baby. And it's just awful. And the man who performed the abortion, he he thought I was too fidgety to be in his clinic. And so he took me to the hospital so they could put me out completely. And they even changed my name because I had a prominent family. And so, so they changed my name. So I didn't have an abortion that day. Sandy Charles had an abortion that day. I have all the paperwork.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And then I moved in with my grandmother after that because my stepmom hated me. And so I woke up 2 days later and walk into the kitchen. The grandmother, who would not talk to me at all, is now serving me toast with a smile and saying, you know, like, good morning. And we never talk about it. My family never talked. So you can imagine that there's another layer now of wounds. And
what were you feeling at that point? Nothing?
That I honestly believe that that's the moment, and it still has ripple effects into my life today that I'm literally in counseling for, or have been in and out of counseling for. I think that was when I learned to numb out. And here's what I mean by that. Everybody has asked me, how did you feel? And the reality is, I don't know, because I think I stopped feeling. Like, after being gaslit and manipulated and not knowing how to express that, and then having an abortion and not knowing how to express that, I think I learned how to not, I had absolutely at this point zero confidence in anything I might express or any feelings I might feel. And so I became numb. Now, that's not to say I didn't have emotions in general, but it almost became like a child who can't speak, who can't tell you what they're feeling. And that has carried through. I have been in and out of counseling and learning how to have more confidence in expressing how I feel about something, and learning that it's okay to have a view on something. And like, it doesn't mean my views are always wrong or crazy. So anyway, so then I moved back with my mom, and I only moved back because of the boyfriend. I basically stay another year, and it's just hell and just getting worse to the point where my mom and I don't even have a relationship really. And then so finally, for 11th grade, I decided to move back with my dad. And this is where, because I know you're waiting for like, where's the hope? Oh my gosh. Like, what the heck? So this is where, and here's the thing about hope and about the kindness of God, is that all along he had been there. All along he had been there. And I just didn't know it. So for example, when I was a little girl, there was a Bible next to my bed because my stepmom was Catholic. And I remember trying to open it and read it, but I couldn't. But it was there. And so there was this idea of God.
You couldn't read it because you didn't know how to read?
Or what? I knew how to read. I just didn't understand it. I would open up to like Genesis and be like, I don't get this. Put it back. But there was this general idea of God, right? And then when my sister was kidnapped and all of those accusations came about, I was probably 9 when that happened. And I remember praying every single night to a God I did not know, that we would find my sister. And after like 6 or 7 months, they found her. And that cemented in my little girl heart that there was a God.
Okay.
So there was something there. And then when I moved in with my mom and I was there, an uncle came to visit and he gave me a Christian cassette tape. And I didn't know there was such thing as Christian music. I knew there were hymns from the Catholic Church, but I had no idea there was like people who sang about God that weren't hymns. Mm-hmm. And I remember listening and crying out to God and saying, I don't understand what this man is singing about, like this Jesus, but I want it. And this is just God wooing me, right? And then the same uncle takes me to a church and I walk in, and I'd only ever been to a Catholic church. And I walk in and I remember people were smiling and clapping and singing. And I was like, what is this? Why are people smiling in church? Like, it was so weird. And I remember just having, this is nothing against the Catholic Church. Please don't hear that. Right. This is just an experience. This is, I associated my stepmom, who I did not like, with the Catholic Church. So that's okay. It's not about that. So anyway, I walk in and for the first time, I have this thought, and it was like the Spirit's here. And I could like understand the sermon. And it was just such a whiplash. Like, what is this? I never even knew there were like Christian churches like this. I had no idea. I did not even know who Jesus was. Like, when people think everybody knows who Jesus is, I did not. Exactly. I'm 14. I had no idea. And so these were all the ways that the Lord was wooing me. And then finally, when I moved back in 11th grade, I start going to Young Life. And the reason, you know, Young Life, it's that ministry that reaches out to high school students. So I start going to Young Life, and I only go because it's a great way to get out of the house on Wednesday nights, right? Like, it's where all the popular kids go. But of course, again, the Lord is just wooing my heart as I'm finally learning about this Jesus. And I get a New Testament, you know, they give us New Testaments, and I actually can understand it, and I cannot get enough of reading it. And I'm saying, like, I want to follow Jesus. Like, I want to follow Jesus. I'm beginning to understand the gospel and, you know, how this man, God, something dies for me, for my sins. But here's the real moment. Is when I'm in college, it's my freshman year, I get involved with this ministry called the Navigators.
Yes, amazing Bible study.
Amazing, people. Amazing people. And I go to this retreat, and the man gets up on the stage and he says, if Jesus walked in the room right now, what would you do? And I was like, immediately I was like, well, I would hide. Like, he would not want to see me. I had so much shame.
That is such a great question. That is so telling. Wow.
It's so telling, right? I mean, I would never say that now. Now I'd be like, oh my gosh, I'd be so excited. I'd run up and hug him. But I literally was like, I would hide. Like, there's no way he'd want to see me. Nobody had to tell me I was a sinner. Like, I knew. I knew the things I had done. I knew what was in my heart. I knew. I just carried all the shame. I'm sure we got into small groups and somebody told me, but essentially it was this idea of like, Sarah, Jesus knows everything you've ever done and everything you're going to do. And he loves you the same. And this is why he came and died. And like that was, I became the Jesus girl. Like that was it, sold out for him. And that was the beginning of my healing. Because of course, coming to know Jesus and having the Holy Spirit reside in you and the fact that he pursues our freedom in our hearts, because that's what he wants to do. This is sanctification. So that's where it all begins.
Now you untangle all of the shenanigans, you know?
Right.
So for a listener who grew up with, you know, on a Jerry Springer episode as well, and how do you reconcile your knowledge now that Jesus was there and the beer in the Bible and, you know, how do you, because you obviously saw people not living it out. And so that's where some people choose to say, then I don't want to be like that, which is not
right.
A representation of Jesus, but.
Right. Right. So let me just say this. First of all, my encounter with Jesus was so profound that I never even associated my mom that she knew Jesus. Okay. So second of all, here I'm reading this Bible and I'm learning more and more. And there's all this keeps coming up. Love your neighbor, love your enemy, like forgive. And I am like, oh, at this point, I want nothing to do with my mom. I don't live with her. I hate her. I don't want anything to do with her. But yet I'm now a Christian and I'm reading about forgiveness. And I'm like, how am I going to forgive my mom? Like, how am I supposed to forgive her and love her? And that began a years-long process of the Lord so tenderly leading me. One, there were three significant things. And I delve into them in the book, but one, learning how to deal with the lies I had believed and replacing them with the truth.
Lies in general or lies about her or?
So that's a great question. So my own core lies. So I learned this concept, core lies. And it's this idea that because of childhood wounds or trauma or whatever, we all have these deep-seated lies that we believe about ourselves, about God, about others. And they can range from like, I'm not good enough, you know, I'm a failure, I'm stupid. And really, that's the lie is more the goals we make, which is I have to be smart. Like, I have to be good enough. I have to be pretty. It's we make these goals. And this is a whole long thing. But I began to see the lies that I had believed and then began replacing those lies with truth. And it was so eye-opening and so mind-blowing. And one of the things I most credit from my years in the Navigators was learning this. Hugely significant. And so that's a very brief, hardly an overview. The next very significant thing was learning how to set boundaries with my mom and how you probably read the story in the book, of course, where I'm in class in college and we have this addiction counselor come in and speak. And of course, afterwards I run up to him and I am like, how do I deal with my mom? Like, I'm on the phone with her and it just goes to crap and like it spirals down and we're in this terrible rhythm and we're so tangled up. And
you're like the underdog, right? And so to set a boundary when every boundary you've ever set has been, you've been ridiculed for it. And you know what I mean? Like, well, it's so.
I didn't even know there was such a thing as setting boundaries. Okay. Like not even, didn't even occur to me. And I said to him, like, what do I do? And he said to me, if I have a ball in my hand and I throw it to you, what are you going to do? And I said, well, I'm going to catch it. And he said, and then what? And I said, well, I'll throw it back. And he said, okay, so you've decided to play the game. And this was my first introduction to boundaries. He said, if you don't want to play the game, stop throwing the ball back.
Listen, you having that in your book, that like exploded my brain. And I've read boundaries, I've been in counseling, but the idea of not throwing the ball back, stop.
Right? Game changer, literally. Yeah. I know. And everybody has to figure out what that practically is for their situation. But for me, it meant like when my mom would call, instead of getting like trying to defend myself or tell her how she hurt me or whatever the spirals and rhythms we are in, he taught me to say like, hey, mom, there's someone at the door. Got to go click. Or hey, mom, got to go click. Like hang up the phone, which sounds cruel. But anybody who knows who's in a difficult, tangled up relationship, like you don't get off the phone or you don't get out of the house. Like it just constantly goes on and on until it blows up. And so I had to literally just hang up the phone in order to set that boundary. Like, and so I think the first time I said like, mom, if you talk to me like this, like I'm going to have to hang up the phone. Why would you say that to me? Blah, blah, blah. You know, the whole thing. But after that, I would not explain myself. I would just say, hey, mom, got to go. Sorry. Bye. Click. Not even wait for a goodbye. Of course, she didn't like it. Nobody likes when you set boundaries, but I had to do it for my own sanity. And then those boundaries also led me to take 6 months off from not talking to her, which was a whole other thing that.
And that feels so scary at the time.
It's scary. You feel like a jerk and you feel unloving. But the thing is, I had to learn to get clear because remember, I didn't know what was up and what was down. And if I was going to really love her and forgive her, like Jesus was asking me to do, then I had to get clear. I needed some counseling. I had to get clarity. And so that's what the Lord did. He led me to counselor. Like he was the one who brought these things up and would guide me. And then the third thing is that, and this was really significant and it sucked at the time, but I was in counseling. I think I was like a junior in college, and I'd been angry for all these years at my mom, just real ragey and angry. Well, underneath all of that anger, I realized I was really sad. Like by my junior year in college, I started to see how other girls would be with their moms and they could talk to their moms about boyfriends and their moms would hug them. And I, all of a sudden, was a deep guttural sadness was inside of me. And so I took myself and my mother issues to a counselor and I explained, and she said, Sarah, and I'm waiting for her to say like, you can have that relationship with your mom. Like it's going to be okay one day, blah, blah, blah. She doesn't say that. She says, Sarah, you need to learn how to mourn the loss of a mother because you don't have one. And I was like, what? And she said, you need to mourn her as though she has died because you don't have a mom. And the process of mourning or grieving is the process of facing reality and letting go of expectations. And the reality is you do not have a mother. Now, that does not mean that we don't hope. Hope is in the future. Hope says what if, right? So we don't ever want to mourn what God may yet restore. But that reality in the previous, you know, years of her with her was that I did not have a mom. And so I had to learn to grieve that as though she died. It was extremely painful. But what that did was it allowed me to let go of the expectation that she was going to act like a mother. It allowed me to see her as a human made in the image of God in need of love. And I was not to look to her to give me what my little girl heart needed. It was not going to happen.
So you kind of let her off the hook because she can't do it anyway.
Yeah, well, it's forgiving her for what she should have been.
Yeah. I just mean like, yeah, stop expecting that next time I talk to her on the phone, she'll.
Exactly, exactly. And so I felt called to love her as a human made in the image of God who was broken too. And so that is how I was really able to continue on in a relationship with her. But because I learned how to set boundaries, I would maybe, if I went to visit her, like I would stay at a different place or I would only, you know, for a few days or like I had boundaries in place. And so those were three really significant things that were really, really helpful in how I learned to love and forgive her.
That's so good. And I think when setting boundaries with dysfunctional family members, we have to give ourselves grace that we don't know what the appropriate boundary is. You know what I mean? Like, I felt like I always wished that I had known what the right boundary was because I was so afraid of messing it up because I'd been told for so long that I was messing everything up. Like, I got told all the time, you're controlling and you're sensitive. And I was like, okay, so then you're not allowed to have feelings or have any say in anything. It was a really great
situation. It's totally invalidating your feelings. And it's really easy to do to our kids, to our spouses.
Heavens. Yeah, so let's talk about that. You grow up, you have children. I would assume having daughters might be petrifying.
Okay, so I get this question a lot too. So this is actually, I would say, the number one thing. So all of those other things were helpful in freeing my heart, teaching me truth, you know, all of these things, right, to get to emotional and spiritual health. But as far as having kids, I would say that one of the biggest things that has helped me to love my children in freedom, and obviously imperfectly, and not put my dysfunction onto them, is dealing with my abortion. Because before, I had numbed out all of those emotions. I couldn't talk about it. I just assumed I was pro-choice. If I saw a little girl, for example, who was 5 years old, I'd tear up and not know why. All of these tangles that I had. And I think had the Lord not led me into post-abortion healing, I think I would have significantly more problems with my kids. However, He, through a series of incredible things, led me to a crisis pregnancy clinic, which I didn't even know those things existed. Mm-hmm. And I ended up getting post-abortion counseling from the most wonderful, gentle woman. And that did so much to free my heart. And the Lord has used that since for me to, because I went through healing, because He did so much freedom, that I was able to talk about it. And the first time He told me to tell my story online, I cried and cried through doing it. But I was trying to be obedient, and I had done the work, you know. And then since then, being able to say the thing that's so shameful for so many people, there's just been so much freedom there. And that, I think, dealing with our pain and our wounds and our sin and getting help, you know, and really facing them and letting the Lord do that work, that is probably the most significant thing for how we parent our children, is if we deal with our own emotional and spiritual junk. And so I didn't have the fear with my kids. Now, that doesn't mean I didn't have other fears. I've got lots of fears. Like, but as far as that goes, it has allowed me to believe the truth that, like, God's not going to punish me with my kids. Like, I can parent in freedom. Like, we can talk about these things. Like, I told my, when my daughter was 12, the Lord led us to tell her about my abortion, and I was scared to death. But now she's part of a legacy of victory and a legacy of freedom instead of secrets and darkness and bondage. And so I love talking about this with parents, because I really honestly believe that the more we face and deal with our deepest shame, our deepest secrets, our deepest wounds and sin, and then we're able to actually talk about them with our children, because which we're so terrified to do, it just opens up this incredible ministry of freedom and being generational bondage breakers. Because abortion, just that's just one thing that's been in my family. And we can see how my mom, you know, not ever dealing with it, how that impacted me. Well, what if I never dealt with it? Or what if I never told my, you know, daughter? Or like, now we're free. We're free to talk about it. The enemy can't use it against us. He can't use it against me. And so I don't have that fear anymore with my children. And that allows me to just really trust the Lord with them and just be faithful to the best that I can. And yeah.
Tell me about... Do you feel like you've got this kind of tendency to do some of those like sarcastic, like,
oh yes.
What do you do when you sense like, oh man, I'm doing what was done to me?
Oh gosh. I mean, like, I'm still learning these things. So my tendency, I grew up with two very sarcastic parents, but my dad was not as, it wasn't like a cruel, you know. So my husband and I are both extremely sarcastic, but we have to check ourselves. I really have to check myself, because as a counselor once told me, sarcasm is using our head and not our heart. So when it comes to not dealing with things, so there's like a funny sarcasm, but then there's the sarcasm that really you're just hurting somebody because you don't want to actually deal with what's happening in your heart.
Interesting.
And so, yeah, think about it for a minute. Think about the times when your husband is sarcastic with you or you're sarcastic with your kids, and I'll bet you there's something going on underneath it. And so anyway, I have had to learn to, I don't want to be sarcastic to my kids. I mean, we have funny times, but not for real. And I don't want to do that to them. And So I have to check myself there. Another thing that I've really been learning about is that I did not know that I have a tendency to gaslight because I sat under it for so long and that I didn't even know I did it. And as I was talking to my husband about how my mom would gaslight me, like as I've been learning more and more, he said to me, Sarah, like, that's what you do to me sometimes. Like we would be upset about something, right? And then I would get really calm and be like, listen, why are you losing control? Like you have a problem. And he's like, it would make me feel crazy. So it's been humbling, but I'm so grateful for the severe mercy of learning because I don't want to be that. I don't want to be that with my kids. I don't want to be that with my spouse. And so continuing to say, Lord, search my heart, like show me any offensive ways in me and lead me in the way everlasting. And the Lord has been doing wonderful work, but it is, I have to be aware that I can have a tendency to do those things. And I just have to be very alert and I have to give my husband permission to gently call me on it. And we have to call our kids on it. So, because they act like us, right? So I caught one of my children, I've noticed a pattern that they will subtly gaslight one of their siblings. And my husband are like, every time we are going to pull them aside, tell them what they're doing and teach them the appropriate response because we have to nip it now. It will not just get better over time.
No.
These unhealthy patterns will just get deeper and deeper.
Because in some jacked up way, they work. So why would they not keep using them?
Right. So we have to call it out. Every time we see it, it has to be called out and dealt with every time.
Yeah. It's just, it's diligence and,
and
remaining. Yeah. Yes. It's humility. It's also holding on to hope because I tend to be like, look, I did it again. This is how I am. This is how it will be. And that's lie.
We can get very defensive because that defense mechanism is because we're actually afraid deep down that we can't change.
Right. No, and I believe that I can't change. It's definitely fear. And so then you kind of just go with it because you're telling yourself that you don't have a choice.
What I've been learning about lately that's been really blowing my mind is that when those accusations come into your mind, what we have really done is probably made, this is a whole other thing, but an agreement with the enemy, with the kingdom of darkness. And so, but we don't know we do it. And it always happens in a moment of pain, usually in our childhood. And so if there's an accusatory thought that continues to come into your mind, like, I'll never change. This is just the way it is. I mean, there's a million. I'm alone in the world. I'm not good enough. Whatever it is. Somehow, somewhere along the line, that was whispered into us by the kingdom of darkness. That's not from the Lord.
No.
And
no.
We somewhere in our spirit agreed with it.
Yeah.
We didn't know we agreed with it, but we agreed with it. And now it has just become a fact in our world. Well, it's true. I mean, I'm never going to change. Like I can point out all the ways in which I'll never change. It's actually an agreement that we need to break. We need to say, like, I revoke this agreement that I made, even if I didn't know I made it. I totally revoke it. I do not agree with it anymore. And instead, I agree with the Lord that he can do anything in and through me. And that, yes, I will still sin sometimes, but I am a saint and I am loved and God continues to work on me. And I will no longer agree with the kingdom of darkness with any of these accusations made against me. Because as Adam Young says, he's a counselor. He has a podcast called The Place We Find Ourselves, which is phenomenal. It's not what the voice is telling you, right? Like maybe you do have a problem with changing. It's the tone of it. What are you feeling? Are you feeling condemned? Are you feeling discouraged? Are you feeling the weightiness of it? That's how you know it's from the enemy because the Lord is kind. His kindness leads to repentance.
No condemnation.
Exactly. The Lord does not condemn. He convicts. That's the difference. The enemy will make you feel like crap. With the Lord, you'll feel a sense of hope. If he's calling you to change something, because maybe you do struggle with, you know, anger or you do struggle with whatever the thing is, he will convict in a way that is kind and that will lead you to feeling like I can run to the Father and he is with me and working on this with me.
That's a good resource. I'm excited to check out that podcast. Tell us about your podcast.
Oh, thank you for asking. So yeah. I have the Complicated Heart podcast, and it's all about dealing with messy heart issues and finding hope and encouragement and practical, tangible solutions to these difficult things in our lives. And so like, you know, where do we find restoration in the ruins? Like, where do we find hope in the pain? Like all of those things. So it's really where I discuss things like my anxiety and depression journey. I interview counselors about addiction or grief, or we talk about abortion, or we talk. It's not a light podcast. It's a positive podcast for sure. Yeah. But we're actually going to deal with the heart stuff. So I have a 3-part series on gaslighting, for example.
Yes, I saw that.
More about that. Or I interviewed Adam Young on trauma. So it's really for somebody who wants to continue to get free. My whole ministry, my whole life, the thing I'm most passionate about is seeing women set free and telling their secrets, coming out of the dark, walking in the light. And so my whole podcast really is about those things. And sort of as a continuation of that, every morning I do a live show. It's called the Get Free Morning Show. It's around 9:15, 9:30 every morning, Monday through Friday. And we talk about all of these things.
Where do you do that?
On Instagram.
Okay. And I have never seen it yet. Oh, I love it.
Every single day, Monday through Friday. It'll eventually be on Facebook too, but right now I only have one phone, so it's just on Instagram live. Know.
That's so good. Sarah Mae, thank you so much. This has been really, really encouraging and helpful. All right, ladies, I hope that you got a lot out of that. I hope you were encouraged. I know I was. To see somebody come from such dysfunction and be just such a voice of truth and freedom, such a reminder that God literally restores all the years that seem like they've been wasted. That's not a problem for him. Okay, so if you are believing something like it's over for you or you're ruined or whatever, none of that stuff's true. And I think sometimes we believe those things and we don't even realize it. I know that for a long time after I got divorced when I was 22, I believed like, because God's nice, he's going to let me like have a fine life or whatever, but he wasn't ever actually going to use me in any way, shape, or form. And that very fundamentally changes the way you live your life. And so I would like to say that is baloney. And so don't believe it, okay? So what will your strategy to struggle well be based on what Sarah Mae said? She said that one of the lies that she believed early on was that she was on her own. And that kind of feeling, that kind of orphan mentality, like nobody's here for you, that again is another lie that fundamentally changes the way that you live your life. So if you believe that it's all up to you, you're the one who takes care of you, no one else is looking out for you, I would love you to challenge that with some truth from scripture. Talk to God about it, see what he has to say about it. And like she said, the voice of the Lord, your dear, loving Father, it is not going to tear you down. It's not going to tell you that you are the worst and it's over for you. None of those things are from your Father. And so we got to get real discerning and serious about thinking through, how is the voice I'm hearing, how is it talking to me? Because if it's telling me like I'm a piece of junk, that's not the Lord. That's not how he talks to us. May have been how your earthly parents talk to you. May have been how you talk to yourself. Probably is. But that is not the way that your Heavenly Father talks to you. Maybe you struggle well this week by getting honest about an abortion that you've had. You are not the only one. You are not past God's grace. I read a statistic that about 33% of women have this as part of their story. So that actually means that just listening to this one podcast episode, there are literally thousands of you. So if you're believing the lie that it's just you, it's not. Okay, so I would really encourage you this week, take a step to get some freedom in this area. Because you can hear in Sarah Mae's story all that not having freedom and healing in this area did. It wreaks havoc in other ways you would not expect. It bleeds into everything. Very honestly, when you have an abortion, it doesn't quote unquote solve a problem. It just opens up a whole lot of hurt in you. And so I would really encourage you to look into that if you haven't. Okay. In the show notes, I put a bunch of like book studies that had high ratings. I gotta tell you, this is not something I know like a great amount about, but please go to counseling. That BetterHelp website, go to betterhelp.com/MSW. You'll get a discount on counseling, and it's done online by actual licensed professional counselors. Do do something, make some step, okay? Even if it's just to tell somebody. And I promise you, if you have had an abortion and you have done the work and you have found the healing, tell somebody, encourage somebody, do something with the hope that you found, because there's a lot of women who are just really struggling or not even looking at it because it feels too painful to even open up. Maybe you struggle all this week by asking this question that has just been on my mind so much that Sarah May said, if Jesus walked in the room right now, what would you do? Wow, that is a really amazing question. I remember my mentor in college, I was struggling with depression and just believing things that weren't true. And my mentor just asked me, if Jesus was sitting on this couch right now with us, what would he say? And I don't know, it helps you realize how much what you're believing is not true, because it wasn't lining up with what I know from scripture God says about me, feels about me, believes about me. So maybe journal through that question. If Jesus walked in the room right now, what would you do? What would you say? And what would he say to you? Really, really good. Maybe what she said about boundaries rocked your world as much as it's rocked mine. If you're in this crazy pattern, this crazy cycle with somebody in your life and you cannot seem to get out of it, realize you being in the cycle is you playing the game. It's you throwing the ball back. It's not much of a game if you just don't throw the ball back. I've been doing this with one of my precious children, and it's been amazing. If you're not engaged in the struggle, then all of a sudden, if I don't throw the ball back, we get to the deeper heart issue. What's actually going on? What are they actually feeling? And then all of a sudden, we're not engaged in a battle, we're engaged in a conversation, and it's actually going somewhere. And I'm not all ruffled up and unable to think clearly. I'm able to enter in and lean in and really listen to the heart of what's going on, because I haven't thrown the ball back. We're no longer engaging in that. And also, I mess up a lot. So please don't hear that everything's great, because it is not great over here a lot of the time, but we are making progress, right? Sarah talked about that podcast called The Place We Find Ourselves. I have subscribed to it. I haven't gotten a chance to listen to an episode yet, but that sounds great. Also subscribe to Sarah's podcast, The Complicated Heart. I would also get that book. It's a really good book. And as always, it would be so great if you would share this episode with someone who you thought of while the episode played. When people come to our minds, I don't think it's an accident. I think that it's God at work. So go ahead and share this episode with the person that you thought of. It's so helpful if you rate this podcast and review it on iTunes. Make sure you're subscribed. Why would you want to miss this? We talk about real stuff and we prank call people, you guys. It's got everything. And don't forget to join me on Instagram this Thursday. We will do a live Q&A, but also just chat. 9 a.m. Thursday on Instagram at Mom Struggling Well. All right, ladies, let me go ahead and pray for us. Lord, your kindness, it's so overwhelming. We kind of don't have a context for it. It doesn't fit into our framework because it's so, so good. Thank you also that you know that our tiny brains are having a hard time comprehending your goodness towards us when we know full well we don't deserve it. Thank you for your grace for decisions that we made that were not well thought out when we were just doing the best that we could. I've jacked up a lot of stuff in my life, and I am fully convinced that you still love me because you didn't expect me to be perfect. I was the one that expected that. Lord, help us discern the difference this week between the enemy of our souls talking to us, whispering lies to us, and your voice, because they are so different. But sometimes, Lord, we just get so caught up in the lies that we are hearing and believing and living out of that we don't stop to hear when you're whispering to us. It's a completely different experience. So, Lord, I pray that you would help these sweet mamas root out those lies, replace them with truth, and live with a deeper sense of the peace they have and the grace they have in you. In Jesus' name, amen.